You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Britain's government is presented with a difficult diplomatic pickle by the apparent attempted murder of a former Russian intelligence officer and his daughter in Salisbury. My guests Florence Biedermann and Carol Walker will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including next month's summit of the Koreas and how much it would be wise to bet on it actually happening, Prince Mohammed bin Salman's UK advertising blitz and whether British newspapers should have refused the accompanying sacks of rials, and how many laws enshrining equal pay does a country need to pass to make it actually happen? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Florence Biedermann, London Bureau Chief for Agence France-Presse, and Carol Walker, former BBC correspondent and journalist. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the UK, the government of which is still trying to figure out how to respond to a bizarre crime committed on British soil by what seems increasingly likely to have been a foreign entity of some sort. It is now known that the Russian intelligence officer turned MI6 asset Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were poisoned with some variety of nerve agent. A police officer who came to their aid was also affected. The British Home Secretary Amber Rudd called it a brazen and reckless attack. Carol, Rudd is saying quite correctly, obviously, that the investigation should be based on facts, not rumour. But this is a tricky one, isn't it?
It is very difficult. And I think it's very difficult for the government to determine how it's going to respond without knowing those facts, without knowing exactly who was behind this. And that may not be easy to establish, even if the security agencies and the biologists do determine precisely what this nerve agent was. We know that the world of the power, the politics, the money swirling around various senior Russian figures who now have washed up largely in London is a complex one, that there are lots of different power struggles going on there. And it may not be straightforward to actually pinpoint this and say, as many, many people suspect, that it is the Russian regime, that it is President Putin and his agencies that are behind this. Now, Amber Rudd and the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary have already said that they will take whatever steps are necessary if Russia does prove to be behind this. But even when it comes to that, I think the options facing the British government are pretty limited. There are already sanctions against Russia. Those have to be done in consort with the rest of the EU, with the United States. Britain acting alone is not going to make a great deal of difference. Those sanctions so far do not seem to be doing much to change President Putin's attitude to things. We are told now that the government is drawing up lists of officials, Russian diplomats who could be expelled. But all of this has to be on hold until and unless there is actually some evidence that means that the government can say you, President Putin, are behind this.
The problem being, of course, Florence, that if the Russian state was behind this at any level, there are going to be any number of deniable layers between it and the crime. We're not going to find somebody who has been captured on closed circuit TV cameras who, when found, has his FSB swipe card in his pocket. I mean, that is not going to happen. That being the case, what do you make of the British government's handling of this? Because obviously its relationship with Russia right now is not good anyway. Well, you know, when has it been? But Russia is still nonetheless an important country that cannot just be dismissed out of hand. How should they be playing this?
Well, I think they would have a bit of time to think about it, because as you say, I mean, before you can know exactly who brought this substance, where it comes from, etc. I mean, it took like 10 years after Litvinenko poisoning,
indeed,
like to establish in an official investigation that Russia was involved, and the judge concluded probably with the knowledge of Putin. So, I mean, now there is the outcry, there is the emotion, there is the theories, the rumors, because it's an extraordinary story. still, after a while, it will be less. The government will be less under pressure to react immediately. And as Carol said, I mean, there are not that many ways to react to if it's proven that it's Russia, like expelling diplomats, like Margaret Thatcher did, like expelling more than 100. I don't think Theresa May would do the same now, but who knows. Sanctions, as Carol said, they are already in place. So, I mean, the kind of reaction you can have if you don't want to start a war is in financial sanctions, of course, in any case, everybody knows they are limited.
Carol, how much more is it going to complicate matters, the fact that even if Russia didn't do this, Russia clearly already, at least, is not entirely unaverse to creating the impression that it might have? Russia's embassy in the UK, its Twitter feed, reliably entertaining. You would have thought this would be a good period for them just to not say anything, but they have been enjoying goading their readers by passive-aggressively tweeting that Skripal was in fact a British spy, because they're taking umbrage with the headline saying that he was a Russian spy. I mean, technically, they've got kind of half a point in that he was sort of spying for Britain, but nonetheless, is this really the time or the place?
Well, they have a point in that Skripal was convicted in Russia of spying for the UK back in 2004.
Indeed, he was.
And the reason he's in this country is because he was part of an exchange of spies. Now, there are all kinds of rumours around that he is still in touch with senior Russian officials, that he is still in touch with senior British security officials. And that is why I think this is so complex, so murky. I think the government is aware that it needs to be seen to standing up to Russia. You mentioned the Litvinenko case. Part of the reason that it took so long to get to the bottom of that is that the government, the Home Secretary, who happened to be one Theresa May at the time, resisted pressure to have a wider inquiry because she said that it would go into intelligence that could not be exposed in that sort of way. And it was only when Litvinenko's widow actually went to court that the wider inquiry was launched. So part of the reason that it took so long to uncover the truth behind that was the government's resistance to dig too deep. I think the government won't necessarily want to make that mistake again. But I think that the complicated and murky world involving espionage, security, the various different players who have different political motivations from Russia who are now in the UK makes this a really difficult one.
Well, complicated and murky indeed, Florence. One of the things we have learned about the unfortunate Colonel Skripal in the last couple of days is that his wife, elder brother and son have all died in the last 2 years. How much stranger can this possibly get?
Well, as Mark Rowley, the head of counterterrorism, said, I mean, even spies die. I mean, now, of course, you can start to have lots of theories. How did they die? Whether it was provoked? I mean, there is no limit to what kind of script of a thriller you can write. But so far, there is no evidence. Still, I mean, the graveyard of the wife was cordoned by the police in Salisbury. So there are obviously some questions around her death. Maybe we will have more answer on this.
And beyond that, there are another 14 cases which the BuzzFeed news agency has identified where people who were known opponents of the Putin regime have died in suspicious circumstances where nothing has been proven. And I think that if there is a proven link to Russia in this case, if there is even, I think, a huge amount of circumstantial evidence pointing to Russia, then I think there will be pressure on the government and on the police to look again at some of these other cases.
OK, well, let's take a look now towards the two Koreas, which are currently enjoying what appears to be something of a post-Olympic rapprochement, though decades of precedent counsel against betting too heavily on a happy ending, at least until North Korea throws a massive fit about some trifling or indeed imaginary slight. The leaders of the two nations are due to meet next month at Panmunjom, which is, of course, where the agreement which paused the officially ongoing Korean War was signed in 1953. North Korea, at least according to South Korea, is willing to discuss dismantling its nuclear weapons if its safety can be guaranteed. Florence, are we expecting a difference of opinion over what guaranteed means?
Well, you can be optimistic and think that something will happen. It seems very, very premature to think that there is really a thaw and that something will happen. So, yes, it's words. It's kind of a change of vocabulary by North Korea. There is indeed something happening, like they are ready to come to South Korea. I think it would be the first time since the division of the peninsula. But still, I mean, there is a long way to go before any kind of guarantee or any kind of agreement can happen.
I mean, Carol, this is the case. You can be optimistic about that and suggest that maybe North Korea is semi-sincere and is just looking for a face-saving climb down. You can be pessimistic and suggest that they're just running out the clock while they continue work. These, of course, were both theories that were floated during the negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program. But given what's 2018 minus 1953, that's quite a long time. That's 65 years of precedent now, if I've done my maths right. Is there much cause for optimism on this occasion?
Well, look, I think anything that moves us on from a situation we were in just a few weeks ago when President Trump and Kim Jong-un were basically competing as to who could come up with the most threatening language and who could claim they had the biggest and most powerful missiles and what they were going to do with them. Anything that moves us on to that, where North Korea is saying that it wants to discuss the terms of some kind of truce, that it is prepared to discuss the future of its nuclear program, that has to be welcome. It has to be a step in the right direction. But of course, given the whole history of this, people will be questioning what North Korea's motives are. There does seem to be a sense in which the very severe sanctions, international sanctions against North Korea, really are biting, and that the North Korean regime wants to find a way of at least reducing some of them, at least getting a few more vital shipments of important things such as medicines and so on into the country. But I think it is not at all surprising that South Korea, and in particular countries like Japan and China, have been saying, well, look, what we need to see is some kind of proper, verifiable indications of what North Korea is prepared to do to lessen its nuclear arsenal. And until and unless they see that, which we're still obviously a very long way away from, then they're going to be very wary indeed of what exactly North Korea is up to.
Florence, we have in that answer there heard the name of US President Donald Trump invoked. If this summit occurs, he will, of course, claim it as an immense personal triumph, because he claims everything that happens as an immense personal triumph, unless it's a bad thing, in which case it's obviously somebody else's fault. But if this summit goes ahead, and when he claims it as an immense personal triumph, will he be entitled to make that claim? Is there an argument that his slightly less nuanced approach to Pyongyang might actually have paid some dividends?
It was not really a slightly nuanced approach. It was a very, very aggressive approach. So, and I think it's always been very difficult to determine what kind of approach you could have with Pyongyang. So maybe that kind of provocative talk in the end started something. I mean, it's really too early to say. But in any case, something moved. And a few months ago, nobody would have thought that there would be a North Korean official coming to the Olympic Games in the South. So wait and see.
I mean, if you spend enough time worrying or thinking about North Korea, you do start to become perhaps hypersensitive to straws in the wind. Carol, at the Pyeongchang Games, they famously marched under a joint flag, the combined Koreas. At the upcoming Winter Paralympics, they have been unable to agree on such a compromise. Is this the kind of thing which is likely to escalate over the next few weeks into an absolutely hideous row, which results in absolutely everybody withdrawing their invitations to everybody else?
Well, I think the point is that we are at the very early stages of this. You know, so far, North Korea has said it's willing to talk. It would be quite significant if they did indeed attend this summit. That would be the first time a senior North Korean politician had actually gone to South Korea on a formal political mission like this since the war which ended in 1953. So that would be significant in itself. But yes, I think there's a lot of concern here that North Korea is simply trying to play for a bit of time. It's interesting that President Trump, who we were talking about, he'd promised fire and fury against the North Koreans. He's now tweeted to say that the US is ready to go hard in either direction, which is clearly keeping all his options open. And I think it's worth remembering that people like the Japanese are really concerned that President Trump, with his America First agenda, if he feels that North Korea is prepared to maybe give up some of those longer range missiles that are threatening the United States, might leave him with some of the other weapons, which means that Japan and other countries closer to North Korea are still very vulnerable. That is a big concern, I think, amongst countries such as Japan. And, you know, perhaps on this, President Trump is right to keep his options open.
Florence, just to go back on this to where we came in, obviously, were North Korea to dismantle its nuclear weapons, it's still not short of firepower. It would be able to defend itself against most comers, you would think. What it wouldn't have would be the ability to launch strikes far away, even on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. There are precedents for countries which have dismantled nuclear arsenals. South Africa did, Ukraine did, Iran sort of decided not to go ahead with it. Do any of those precedents seem applicable to you? Is it imaginable that North Korea would do this?
Right now, it's difficult, but why not? I mean, why wouldn't there be, let's dream or let's hope for the better. Why wouldn't there be a kind of thawing? Why wouldn't there be a new generation or people, a more open world? Or maybe also because of internet, like maybe there are more people aware in the north of what's happening around them. It's difficult to check, but so why not think of an evolution? Like over years, that could reach such a result. Yes, why not?
Okay, well, on that optimistic note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Florence Biederman and Carol Walker. Coming up next, Prince Mohammed's ad blitz.
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this year we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul, or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. Why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Florence Biederman and Carol Walker. Now, if there is a single citizen of the United Kingdom unaware of this week's visit by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, it will not be due to any advertising underspend by the House of Saud. Newspapers, websites, social media, billboards and many other vertical surfaces have been plastered with cheerful images of the Saudi heir, along with elevating summaries of his plans for reform. Although these, on a cursory reading, appear to stop short of lifting a dress code imposed on half the population under threat of violence. Carol, first of all, newspapers in particular, should they be taking Saudi Arabia's advertising business?
Well, look, you know, this is a commercial business, isn't it? And if the Saudis are offering newspapers money, they presumably feel that they are perfectly entitled to put out these adverts. It is all rather creepily reminiscent of you visit the regime of some Middle Eastern dictator. And of course, that is what a lot of people feel that Mohammed bin Salman is, and that perhaps...
Well, he's not yet, but he will be in due course.
He is effectively the leader
Indeed.
Of his country. He is the man who is driving the political change in the country. The government here has come under a great deal of criticism for literally rolling out the red carpet for Mohammed bin Salman. He gets lunch with the Queen, he gets to meet the Prime Minister and so on. But I think what is interesting is that a aside from the newspapers, I think the government has clearly taken a strategic and an economic decision that it is important to build its alliance with Saudi Arabia. We've had defence deals worth billions of pounds, and many hundreds of jobs in this country are dependent on those ties with Saudi Arabia. There is rightly huge criticism of Saudi's role in Yemen, where its blockade of the ports is causing huge suffering in the country, children literally dying of diseases such as cholera because they cannot get the medicines in. The government is saying that it is going to raise those issues with the Saudis, but it has clearly decided that it is economically and in its strategic interests to maintain and indeed strengthen the alliance with Saudi Arabia.
Florence, do you think the ads are actually effective messaging? I was quite taken by the one that said Prince Mohammed is, and I quote, empowering Saudi women.
Well, they can drive, they can go to the cinema soon, like not yet. Yeah, of course. I mean,
big deal.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, but I think we have to talk about realpolitik here. I mean, Saudi Arabia is, let's say, in a way, facing Iran in Yemen because Iran is supporting the Houthi rebellion. So, yes, they are bombing. Yes, they are blocking port. But who started the situation, if not the rebels? And, there is the industry of defense, armament, etc. There are lots of money at stake. So who are you going to support in the area? Like Iran or Saudi Arabia? And this is a choice like all Western countries have made, including President Trump, which he did maybe a bit too decisively, trying to marginalize Iran. But this is a choice all Western countries have made. Let's support Saudi Arabia, even if we don't quite agree with the regime and the way it treats the woman. If it's to face like Iran, the role of Iran in Syria, supporting Bashar al-Assad and so on. I mean, this is the alternative.
And although we can say that, my goodness, allowing women to drive, it seems extraordinary to us in the West that women are not allowed to do that. Certainly the view of the British government and many people say, well, look, this is a Middle Eastern regime which is taking steps at least in the right direction. Mohammed bin Salman is somebody who is trying to confront some of the most conservative clerics who are very powerful in Saudi Arabia. He is attempting to open up the country to liberalise social rules. He is attempting to tackle some of the corruption going on there. And certainly the British government believes that it is very important that he is seen to be having Western allies in that process. He has to get some kind of respect for at least taking those steps in the right direction. And given that it is one of the few stable regimes in that part of the world, I think it is clear that Britain has taken that decision, not least because of the strategic decisions which you were talking about there in Yemen. I think there's also some pretty hard economics going on here. There's not only the defence deals. We know that the government wants the Saudis to float their oil giant on the British stock exchange. So there are financial issues there. They've already signed billions of dollars in future deals covering things like education and trade. And at a time when Britain is leaving the EU, in case some people might have missed that Brexit vote, it needs other allies.
Florence, who is the audience for the ads? Are they attempted to make the British public who may happen to see them think better things about Saudi Arabia? Or is the scale of the advertising campaign actually intended as a demonstration of Saudi Arabia's power and wealth, saying we can basically buy your newspapers if we feel like it?
Well, no, I think that it was kind of a countering all the demonstrations that have been announced. You know, I mean, since weeks and weeks you hear about Save the Children, like making this incredible demonstration with the statue of a kid, which is quite powerful emotionally. Stop the War also. So it's a response to that that kind of demonstration. And who it reaches, well, when you see the papers when it's published, like The Guardian, the FT, I mean, it's kind of the elite. It's not the population or the message is for people with certain level of education, of money, and that's what they aim at, like to counter what they probably considered as another propaganda, which is the propaganda of the demonstration against the war in Yemen.
Okay, well, finally tonight to France, which has chosen the week in which International Women's Day falls, it is today, to announce concrete legislative steps. Legislative steps, who would put those two words together in a radio script? To close the gender pay gap. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe noting that there remained a 9% disparity on average, despite equal pay laws having been on the books for 45 years, announced that French firms would now have until 2020 to get with the programme or face fines. Florence, on the specific question of France, and obviously France is far from alone in there being a wage disparity between the genders, but it has been quite progressive in theory in that these laws have been on the books for 45 years. How has reality managed to outrun the law for all that time?
Well, because those laws were not that progressive, you know. I mean, it's pretty recent, maybe a dozen years, since there is this request, legal request for equality in salary between men and women in companies. So it's kind of a shortcut to say since 45 years. No, it's not since 45 years. It's progressive. I mean, it has been adopted progressively. And, well, there is kind of impatience now because not much has happened. It didn't reach the level everybody would wish, which means real parity. So,
I mean, Carol, the World Economic Forum said last year that on current pace, equal pay was 217 years away. I, for one, call me a crazy, wild-eyed liberal, would like to see that brought forward a tad.
Funnily enough, I'd agree with you there, Andrew. Yeah, that would be good.
I mean, you know, let's not go crazy, just maybe 105 years or so. But do laws like this, I mean, I guess they can't hurt, but why don't they help more than they seem to?
Well, I think Florence is quite right that it's an incremental thing. And France is already doing a lot better than the UK. In France, the pay gap is 9%. In the UK overall, it's 18%. But if you look at areas like finance and insurance, recent figures from the Office for National Statistics say it's 35%. And we've actually had the TUC, the trades union body here, today coming out and saying that effectively it means that women work for free for 67 days of the year. So in the UK, we're way behind. Next month, bigger companies are going to have to at least reveal the figures of what the pay gap is. So we're so far behind where France is, where they're talking about actually forcing companies to do something about it and actually fining those that don't do it. Things move very slowly. And of course, Europe is way ahead of many other countries around the world. But it's interesting when you look at the comparisons, there are some sort of surprising countries that appear to be doing better than the UK. But then it is because the fact that women are not even in the workplace. So I think, you know, it just illustrates how far we've got to go.
Florence, among the French laws will be one that means that companies that have more than 50 employees will be required to actually use software that maintains pay equality. Is there likely to be any resistance to this fairly intrusive measure?
Oh, well, let's see. No, I don't think so. Why would it? It's not that bothering. I mean, again, it will be a progressive process. They still have some years, so they will have to do it. That's it. But I don't see a strong resistance to that. I mean, everybody has been accustomed to the idea that a gender pay gap was not normal.
But there is still, if not necessarily resistance to the idea, Carol, because I think you'd have to be fairly confidently weird to say that there was a good reason why women shouldn't be paid the same as men for doing the same job. But does it still sort of surprise or frustrate you that there's always attempts to equivocate, to justify, to explain, yes, because, and, but, and we'd like to, but, and so on?
Well, absolutely. I worked for decades at the BBC, and some people may have heard that there was a bit of a row when it was forced to reveal the differences between what it paid men and women. And of course, the BBC said, well, these roles are not equivalent. You know, this editor's role is not the same as that editor's role. They're doing slightly different jobs. And I think many companies do still try to find ways around this. And I think that what is also the case is that there are still many, many companies where women perhaps take a break when their children are young and find when they come back, they've really lost out.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Florence Biedermann and Carol Walker, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Tom Edwards. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thank you for listening.